These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
This week, we celebrate our nation's birth. But for some, July 4th has become a celebration of a country defined by its incorporation of immigrants, a place where people with big dreams can come, work hard, and accomplish incredible things. I'm Peter Biello, and today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with public television host and Italian-Croatian immigrant Lydia Bastianich, as she talks about her book, My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food.
America is open, and America is growing, and America wants to new things and people. And the one thing that you absolutely need to succeed is to roll up your sleeve and work hard.
Lydia Bastianich, today on Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Hear our conversation after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. An airstrike has hit a migrant detention center in Libya's capital, Tripoli. At least 40 migrants are dead. NPR's Jane Arraf reports the United Nations is calling it a possible war crime.
The airstrike was a direct hit on a hangar where migrants were being held next to a militia base in the Tripoli suburbs. Libya's UN-recognized government blames the attack on forces loyal to General Khalifa Haftar, who has been fighting to take control of the capital in the divided country. This week, Haftar's group said it would intensify airstrikes in Tripoli, and it warned civilians to take shelter. Haftar's self-styled Libyan National Army, which controls part of Libya, denies it is behind the attack. Under Libyan and European Union policy, migrants intercepted at sea while trying to get to Europe are sent back to Libya. The country is seen as a gateway to Europe by African migrants who try to cross the Mediterranean. Jane Arraf, NPR News.
A federal judge is blocking a Trump administration policy that would keep thousands of asylum seekers locked up pending the outcome of their cases. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, the judge says asylum seekers have a constitutional right to bond hearings.
U.S. District Judge Marsha Peckman ruled that migrants who are detained after entering the country illegally to seek asylum do have the right to a bond hearing in immigration court. Attorney General William Barr decided in April that the government would no longer offer such hearings and instead keep migrants in custody, part of the administration's broader effort to deter a surge of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. But immigrant rights advocates sued to block the policy, which was set to take effect this month. Peckman ruled that credible asylum seekers must receive a bond hearing within 7 days or be released. Migrants who are released from custody have a much better chance of finding a lawyer and ultimately winning their asylum cases. The Department of Justice is expected to appeal the ruling quickly. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
A U.S. military jury returns to court this morning in California to decide whether a decorated Navy SEAL will spend time in jail. Steve Walsh of member station KPBS reports Edward Gallagher was largely exonerated on charges stemming from his time in Iraq.
SEAL Chief Eddie Gallagher has been found not guilty of the most serious charges he faced, including the murder of a detainee in Iraq. The military jury found him guilty of the charge of posing with a dead body on the battlefield, which carries a maximum 4-month sentence.
Gallagher could avoid jail time altogether if he's given credit for time already served. The trade deficit has risen to $55.5 billion. That's a more than 8% increase from April to May and a 5-month high. Imbalances with China and Mexico widened. This is NPR. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani is threatening to increase uranium enrichment to any amount it wants beginning this Sunday. It's seen as an effort to pressure European signatories to the nuclear deal to ease the strain of U.S. sanctions. The Justice Department says 2020 census forms are now being printed without a citizenship question. The administration is abandoning the legal fight to include it. But NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports President Trump doesn't seem to be ready to back down.
Trump administration officials confirmed Tuesday that paper census forms would be printed without this question. Is this person a citizen of the United States? A majority of the Supreme Court recently ruled to keep it off the census because the administration's reason for it, quote, seems to have been contrived. But President Trump has tweeted that he's asked the Justice Department and Commerce Department, which oversees the Census Bureau, to, quote, do whatever is necessary to bring this most vital of questions to a successful conclusion. A federal judge in Maryland has ordered the Trump administration to reach a written agreement with challengers of the question that confirms the administration is no longer pushing for its addition. That agreement is due by Monday. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, New York.
The U.S. women's soccer team is heading to the World Cup final after beating England last night 2-1. Who they face will be determined today in the semifinal between the Netherlands and Sweden. The U.S. won even though star player Megan Rapinoe was out of the game because of a strained hamstring. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation, supporting the health and well-being of underserved populations at langloth.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
I'm Peter Biello, and today NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth with best-selling cookbook author and restaurateur Lydia Bastianic to talk about her experiences as an Italian-Croatian immigrant who became a successful celebrity chef and public television host.
Buonasera, buonasera. Thank you very much. Oh, what a pleasure. What a, you know, it's really touches me when I get this kind of receptions. And what it tells me is that we connect, that I connect with you in a sense with something that I love, cooking, and that's important to me because I love what I do and I love sharing it. And when I connect with you, sometimes I get emails, I get a lot of emails, but you know, Lydia, less than I, and from all over America, people that, you know, I might never get a chance to see. Lydia, last night in our house, your smells were permeating the whole house. We made this and this. And it touches me because I know that I am present with that family, even though I'm not there. So thank you very much for being here. And, you know, I do a few things, but I'm here tonight actually because of the release of the paperback of My American Dream. And as much as I'm known for being a chef and maybe a mother, grandmother, a restaurateur, and my cookbooks, I know you all enjoy, you know, it's the first time that I wrote about my life. And I thought, I said, you know, is it something that people would love to know, that would like to know? And of course, my editor right away said, Lydia, of course, your story is actually a story that's very contemporary, what's going on. It's an immigrant story of coming to America. And, you know, I was blessed with getting the opportunity or having the opportunity to become who I have become. So maybe just a little bit of history. I know you'll get the book, and please enjoy it, and we'll have some questions with Peter and your questions. But let me just kind of run through a little bit of my life so that I put it into a context. So Italy, if you're looking at Italy, in the right-hand side by Venice, all the way up that way. So let's see if I'm turning it, you will be on that side. Italy would be on that side. There's a little peninsula called Istria. Istria is now Croatia, but it was Italy. And after World War II, it was given to the new, because Italy lost the war, it was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia under Marshal Tito. So I was just born, actually, in that period, because the war ended at 44. The Allied forces were hanging around there until the 47, to decide where actually would the border go and what belongs to who sort of deserves what, not unlike what's going on in the world today. And in 1947, in February, I think it was 26 or 27, the Paris Treaty was signed. And the Paris Treaty really delineated the border where Italy would end and communist Yugoslavia would begin, and Istria and part of Italy was given to Yugoslavia. And so I was just born there in that period. I was born February 47, the 21st, so I was just a few days, I guess, when the change came over. But the idea was that there's, you know, ethnically, that area was very Italian. Actually, 350,000 ethnic Italians moved back into Italy and into the world as a result of World War II and the oncoming of this communism. But we got caught behind the Iron Curtain, and I grew up in a situation that was communist. That our names were changed, we were not allowed to go to church, we were not allowed to speak Italian. So it was difficult. My mother was an elementary school teacher, but you know, when you live on borders like that, you speak more than one language. You are ethnically one. You belong to one ethnicity more than any others, but you kind of on a border, you know, to communicate, you do speak. So we did speak Croatian. Now it's Croatian. Then it was Yugoslavian. It's much the same language, more or less. She was really taken and indoctrinated in the communists and teaching the children that. My father was a mechanic. He had two little trucks, actually, and they took that away. They deemed him a capitalist, put him in jail for quite a few months. And ultimately, so things really began to be tough for my parents. My mother, was wise enough, I guess, to put myself and my brother with my grandmother. Now, my grandmother was about maybe 3-4 kilometers out of the city. And for me, that was, even when I recall it now, was an idyllic place because food was scarce, and grandma and grandpa would supply food for the whole family, not just our family, but my aunts and so on. And we helped. So we were in grandma's courtyard. We had ducks, we had chickens, we had goats, milking the goats in the morning. We had pigs every November. The slaughter, 2 pigs, we would make sausages, blood sausages, you know, the bacon, the prosciutto, all of that. And then, of course, the extension of the garden and the yard. Again, you know, as the seasons came around, spring, peas, favas, artichokes. And I was the little runner, so was my brother. You know, we were the little runners helping grandma and grandpa in all of these chores. It's my connection to food really goes back to that period in time. Because I remember, you know, the smells and the aromas of rosemary, of sage. I mean, I used to help grandma gather the potatoes from the ground, and she would, with the hoe, and I was in back, she would get the big potatoes. I would go with my little basket and get the little ones from the earth. And, you know, I can still recall those potatoes were warm in my hands. And when you touch the tomatoes also are warm, almost like as they had life. But my passion for food and my kind of reference library, if you will, for flavors, I attributed to that period in my life where I was tasting everything as it was in season, intense in flavor, pristine, none of these chemicals and whatever. And when 10 years later, in 1956, my parents decided that maybe they needed to move on because it wasn't getting any better, we had relatives on the other side of the border. And the plot was that we were going to go visit a sick aunt in Trieste. Now, as children, we didn't know that. But not all of us got the visa. My father had to remain as a hostage. They knew if they gave the whole family the visa, that we would not come back. So we went over, the three of us, my brother, my mother, and I. My aunt wasn't as sick as it was meant to be, but, you know, I I didn't make anything out of it. But about 2 weeks later, really in the middle of the night, ultimately, a knock on the door and my mother crying, my aunt also crying, my father appeared. He had escaped. He escaped the border. He was shot at. The dogs ran after him, the scent dogs, but he made it. And that's after a few days, I realized that we are not going back and that I hadn't unfinished business, that I had not said goodbye to grandma, to grandpa, to my goats, to my friends. And I think that, you know, the connection with food and aromas is what I brought with me. So I remember cooking even with my great aunt in Trieste and trying to recapture all the flavors that I remember from grandma. And for the rest of my life, my communicator has been the food, my passion, my love for food, and always trying to capture those aromas that I recall as a child, because that brought me close to grandma. Now, I know a lot of you, when I talk about it, a lot of you, oh, did you see grandma? I did see grandma. I saw grandma about 10 years after I went back, actually, with my husband on my honeymoon, actually. And so, you know, she was still in that courtyard still. And till this day, I go back. I go back to that courtyard. It's empty now, really. You know, the cousins, the youngsters are in the cities and they have gone. But I find still peace and solace. There was a pine forest right behind it, and we used to go forage there with grandma for wild asparagus every spring, or for the wild chicory, the dandelion. And I still do that. I'm going to go there in April because I can't miss spring there. It just takes me back, and it gives me sort of reassesses me, rebalances me. But in Trieste, and I'm going to make it so fast forward because I know that Peter will ask me a lot of questions. We ended up, because we were refugees, we didn't have the papers, we ended up asking for asylum, my parents did, and ultimately we ended up in a political refugee camp for 2 years, stayed there, awaited for an opportunity to get accepted by at that time, it was Canada, it was the United States, Argentina was also taking in people. So, of course, you know, our first choice was America. And in 1958, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and he did open immigration for people fleeing communism. And we were one of the first family. And thank you. We had nobody, in a sense, here. The Catholic Relief Services brought us here. Then we researched after a while, because I know one of my cousins is right in this audience. We found out that Grandma Rosa's sister lived in Pennsylvania near, actually, Sunbury and Shamokin and there. And ultimately, we reunited with them. But initially, we didn't have anybody to connect to. And the Catholic Charity brought us here. And, you know, the amazing opportunity that we had as an immigrant family, four of us, not having any connections, not having money, that we were taken in, we were brought to America, we were given an opportunity to, first they put us in a little hotel, fed us there, then found a job for my father, found a little home. And I can't tell you how much the neighbors themselves, the Italian community, the Red Cross, helped us to furnish our house. People would come with chairs, with towels, with sheets, with bagfuls of food. You know, I was 12 years old at that time, and I really recall this kind of welcome. And I recall how happy I was that finally I'm going to be in one place, that I'm going to be secure, that I'm going to have roots. And I am forever grateful to America, because there is no place in the whole world like America. And And so, you know, I felt I have to, you know, I mean, the opportunities, the living well, and all this kind of look at, you know, having all of you speaking to you. This is, for me, is a tremendous achievement and opportunity that I was given. And I certainly want to pay homage to that opportunity and to all of those that gave me that opportunity, and continuing to kind of maybe share what can happen if you give somebody a chance or an opportunity to. Yes, you know, when we came, coming here, the 2 years in camp, they were long 2 years. We were vetted. We were quarantined. But at the end, you know, when they sort of said, you know, this is a good, healthy family, a family that will work, we want to welcome them in America. And we were literally welcomed here, you know, I remember when we met with the social worker, and the social worker initially you would meet every week, and they spoke Italian, and they put us first in a hotel, and then they would give my parents some money for my parents to feed us until they found a job for my father and a home for us. And I recall my mother, she would kind of write down every amount of money that she got. And after a year, we would go visit them, the social workers. Once a year, they wanted to know how we were doing. And once my parents worked, she accumulated the money, and she went on the meeting, and she said, "This is how much I owe you. I want to pay you back." And I recall, you know, because my mother was crying, she said, the social worker says, "No, you keep this. You continue for spend it on your children because we want you to be part of America." So that was, you know, as an immigrant, this is what I recall. So I can't be grateful enough, and certainly the time is when I feel I need to give back and share and do as much as I can for people that need it out there. And of course, to do what I love, and that is, you know, cook and my show and whatever. And of course, I think you all know family is so important to me, I think, you know, because when we first came here, I mean, the roots of Italian family, then coming and traveling and not having anybody else except the four of us, family kind of was the security, if you will, that we had, my brother and I, and we still remained in, I always remain in that mode, but that's very Italian. My mother, 98, I know you all love her because... She is fine, she lives with me, and when I come back, she's gonna ask me all about what happened. And I tell her, I says, "You know, Grandma, you're more popular than I am. They all ever..." And she says, "Oh, no, you worked hard." But, you know, the reality is that, you know, my success is based on all the good people, but certainly on my whole family. And I always tell my children and everybody, we did what we did because we were together as a family and the support of the family. Thank you very much.
Restaurateur Lydia Bastianich there, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. I'm Peter Biello. And when we return, Bastianich sits down with me for an interview from the stage at the Music Hall for this edition of Writers on a New England Stage.
This is NHPR 924. Good morning. As NHPR begins our new fiscal year, we'd like to thank all of our members. Your support keeps this service strong and makes possible everything you hear on NHPR. Please know your impact is real and your generosity is appreciated. Thank you. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit specializing in college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org. And from Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, a downtown meeting place for books, greeting cards, games, toys, and coffee. Calendar of author book signings and events at gibsonsbookstore.com. Sunny and hot today. High temperatures from mid-80s to around 90 degrees. Mostly clear tonight. Overnight lows lower 50s. Northern New Hampshire ranging lower 60s in the south. Then tomorrow, Independence Day, sunny and hot. Highs around 90 degrees. This is NHPR.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Lydia Bastianich, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. I spoke with Bastianich about her early struggles as a restaurateur in New York City and took questions from the audience. Lydia Bastianich, thank you very much for being here for Writers on a New England Stage. This is just an incredible honor.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for being here with me.
It's just so wonderful, and your book was wonderful, and one moment in your book that I want to point out that I found particularly meaningful was there was a moment towards the end where you pivot the narration from addressing the reader to addressing your grandchildren. And you say, I'm paraphrasing here, that this story is for you, my beloved grandchildren, because I think you wanted them to know your story, right? Where you came from, both from an immigration standpoint, but also from a business person standpoint, how you got to this moment in your life, how you got to become the person they know as their grandmother. Is that an accurate description of why you chose to write this for them?
Absolutely. You know, I always involved, as I was talking, my family and my children and my grandchildren, and we go back to Italy, we go back to Istria. I took every single one of them to the camp, showed them the room that we spent 2 years in. Because
the camp, we should mention, this is where you spent in detention, San Saba, was it?
San Saba in Trieste, Saba. Right. Mm-hmm. Now it's a museum, so mm-hmm. if any of you go there, go and visit it. I was on the second floor on the left side, middle. It's kind of, it had burnt since. But it is very important for me that my children, and especially the next generation, my grandchildren, understand what it takes, you know, to make a good life, a healthy life. And I don't want them ever to take for granted the opportunities that we were given and in turn that they have, and that they need to give to this world. First, I always tell them you need to develop yourself, become the best you can, and then you need to incorporate the rest of the world in your life. So I don't want them to ever forget or take for granted the opportunity that their family was given. Mm-hmm.
You came to America, and as you mentioned, you got some assistance from Catholic Charities. You and your family worked very, very hard. And you always had this love for food. What made you and your family decide, I need to start a restaurant? Because I think a lot of us, right, we've made a really good sauce at one point. We're like, you know, we could do this restaurant thing, like, someday professionally. But you actually took the step to do that.
Well, you know, I won't take the credit personally. Food was always the growing of it, the making of it, the lack of food. You know, when I was in the camp, you had to go in line for food with a little plate, and whatever you were given, that's what you had. And then coming here, the opportunities of food, and ultimately building my life around food. So food always had a big part, is a big part of my life. But actually, the person that got me into the business was my husband. And he was also an immigrant. We met here in New York. But he was working in the restaurant business, the front of the house, as we call it. You know, waiters, maitre d', and so on. And he was the one, after we had our first child, now, even after I was married, I would work part-time in restaurants and so on. And he wanted to open a restaurant. So I said, okay, I'll help you. And we found this little 9-table restaurant in Forest Hills. And, we dived in with all of the money that we had, my mother's money, everybody sort of chipped in. And I wasn't a chef by then. So we hired a chef because I didn't feel confident enough to be a chef. I was young. I just didn't have any restaurant experience, big restaurant experience. But what I decided was that I would become his sous chef. So I went in the kitchen as the sous chef for 10 years. I kind of worked with him, really honed down my skills in the kitchen. But also thereafter, I realized how much I didn't know. So every visit to Italy, a vacation in summer, I would go in Italy and work with chefs in Italy. I'd take courses in the science of food. All that interests me. And for 10 years, I kind of honed my skills as a chef. And then, by then, we were successful because the food was good. So with him, with this chef in the kitchen, he cooked Italian-American food, but I began slowly to add my specialties, you know, like risotto and polenta, and people loved it. I said, uh-huh. So by then we had two restaurants. We sold them, and we opened Felidia in 1981 on 58th Street, and that's where I became the chef, and I cooked the regional food of Italy.
And you just glossed over one of the most stressful moments of the book, I think, selling two restaurants and then buying the one in Manhattan. In the book, you describe just how stressful that was and how you buy a place and then you realize, oh, no, this needs a lot more work than I thought. But and you also describe yourself as kind of a natural risk taker, believing that your hard work would sort of see you through.
Well, I think so. You know that I think if you're see an opportunity, you need to analyze it and, you know, see if you want to take that opportunity, if it'll make you grow, and ultimately if you're prepared for that opportunity. But yes, we sold both restaurants in Queens that we had in those 10 years, and we leveraged all of that money into building Felidia. But, you know, we made our plans, our budgets, but a lot of out-of-budget items came on the agenda. I mean, the whole building needed underpinning. What did I know about underpinning? But unless we underpinned the building, it would have collapsed because it was the old buildings, the brownstones with bricks, you know, and not even the mortar. It was just kind of a sand. And so that was a $300,000 over budget, and we just didn't have it. So we almost didn't open it. I remember, you know, for the workers just wanting to finish, I would cook. You know, I had like a little gas stove. I would cook for the workers so they would work late, so that they would say, I mean, I was trying to tempt them the only way I could, which was with good. And we ultimately opened not finishing everything. You know, the dining room where the people would see and the bathroom, that, but the cellar wasn't finished. This part of the kitchen were not finished. Well, we opened and we got started. And, you know, the revenue started coming in and then we continued. So it was, we almost didn't make it.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the moment that Julia Child and James Beard made an appearance in your kitchen? Because you did not have much warning that they were coming.
No, no. Well, you see, there I was. So it was... you know, this Italian young woman chef. I mean, all the chefs in New York were the French haute chefs, you know, with their cat. And I was simple. I had my slippers in the kitchen. That's how simple I was. You know, but who is she cooking? So the press came and, you know, what is polenta or risotto or all of these, yotta. I made yotta. I bet you don't even know what yotta is.
I do not know what that
okay.
is.
Okay, I'll tell you quickly.
Please do.
Pasta fagioli, bean and, okay. and macaroni. But instead, up north there, where we would put, instead of pasta, sauerkraut in the beans and potatoes. So it's yotta. So if you go to Trieste, especially in the winter, ask for yotta. So I was cooking these things. So of course the press said, what is she cooking? And once the press get involved, then everybody else gets curious. And one evening there appeared, I mean, they called, but, you know, it was still Julia Child and James Beard. I mean, they were towering figures. They were big, both big. And so we gave them the biggest table. And of course, I went out and I talked to them. What she wanted was risotto with mushrooms. She wanted to eat it. She loved it. She wanted to know how to make it, whether I would teach her. She came back. Ultimately, she even came to the house, and I taught her how to make the risotto. She loved it. We remained friends, actually, until her very end. But the thing that made difference is that she asked me to come on her show. She had the MasterChef series then. And we did two episodes, and, you know, that was my entree into the TV world.
I have more questions about your career in TV, but I want to ask one more question about immigration. And that is, you know, you're describing America as a place of opportunity for you. Do you feel someone coming over from Italy or another country right now could, through just grit and determination like you've shown, sort of achieve something similar? Is it possible now?
I think it's still possible. America is still full of opportunities. I think the getting here, it's more selective and difficult and all of that. But I think if somebody comes here with the right entrees, being vetted, having all the papers, and, you know, having some sort of a specialty, you know, that they can offer to America. America is open, and America is growing, and America wants to new things and people. And the one thing that you absolutely need to succeed is to roll up your sleeve and work hard.
So, okay, TV question. To what extent did you come naturally to television, and what did you sort of need to learn as you were becoming a person seen on TV?
Well, I had some interviews here and there, but I had not done television. What happened? The producer, Julia's producer, asked me, you know, Lydia, you're pretty good. How about a show? And I knew that I want. So, you know, I thought about it 2 minutes. But I did. I wanted two things. And one of the things was that I wanted to be on PBS because, you know, what public television, for that matter, radio, offers is an intelligent discussion, an intelligent presentation of something. And I wanted to be part of, because I wanted to share my passion, my country, my culture with America. America was good enough to accept me. And I wanted to tell them who I was. And the second option that I asked for was that it's filmed in my house. Now, for that, the first, I'm on television 20 years now, I think the first 15 years were all filmed in my kitchen. And that was because I was not used to studios. I figured if I'm in my kitchen, I know my range, I know everything, I know where the knife is and whatever. And so it did work, because in my house I was very comfortable. But I did want to communicate. And what I made a conscious decision, because I was watching Julia, of course, on PBS, was that she was not about herself and showing her capabilities as a chef, but she wanted to transcend the lens and reach the audience out there, and she wanted them to cook. And I said, that's what I want to do. So in a sense, she was my mentor. And she did tell me, she said, you know, Lydia, you do for Italian food what I did for French food. And the question for me was, you know, I wanted to reach to the people out there and have them cook the food that I loved. That, I think, is, you know, if I can show how much I know, how long could that last? You know, you need to, if somebody gives me half an hour of their time, their precious time, and watches me, then they better take something away from it. I better share, give them something. But I love it, because with every piece of information, as I was saying before, my aromas, my flavors permeate their house. So we have a deal going.
You've said that the food industry is tough on women. What makes it so tough?
It is a tough industry. It's a tough industry because it is physically hard. It is scheduling hard for a woman, and especially once a woman begins to think about a family. And it's just a lot of tension and pressure. And, you know, it was an industry that, especially in the kitchen, the blowing off of steam, literally, was kind of almost okay. Now, you know,
What do you mean by that, blowing off of steam?
I mean, you know, if a chef was mad and threw the pot in the sink with everything, or they would chase somebody out, and so on. That was kind of, you know, part of the game. Now, in Italy, you know, maybe one of the reasons why I kind of all these hurdles, I went over this hurdle, because in Italy, women are in the kitchen. The kitchen is a woman's domain. Even in restaurants, you know, now you have the chefs with the toque. But you know, in the restaurants around Italy, the women were in the kitchen, the wife was in the kitchen, the husband was prancing around the front. So... So, you know, for me, it was okay to be in the kitchen. You know, I felt comfortable. I'm going to take this over. There's no problem. But I think also I was blessed with the fact that it was a family business. My husband was up front. And so, but along the way, getting ever more involved in the industry and doing events with other chefs, yes, women had a hard time, and I think things are certainly changing, which is great. The hard time of being maybe a bit abused is bad enough, but the question was that they didn't have the opportunity to own restaurants, because that's when you're really the boss, when you own or whatever. And what I found out, especially when I had difficulties with building Falidia, and my husband got sick, and I went to the bank, and they wouldn't give me a loan because until I brought my husband. You know, the financial institutions are not considering women enough in supporting them in opening restaurants.
Still, this was definitely something you encountered.
Still, actually, about 15 years ago, I was one of the founders of the group Women Chefs and Restaurateurs. And it's still an organization that goes very well. And the idea was not kind of a gathering of women to kind of lament, but it was one to bring women chefs in contact with the financial world, bankers and American Express, so that they have an opportunity that they understand that women are capable of doing this. And this is when you really get the power, when you are the boss.
So there's the financial aspect of the restaurant industry being...
That's still a big thing for women to move up.
Mm-hmm. And there's also some chatter about the culture of the restaurant industry being something of a boys' club. Is that true in your case?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's much less... It was, and as I say, you know, I was a little protected because of the family situation. But when I'm asked to speak, and inevitably, you know, there's always questions of my advice to women. And I always say the number one thing that you owe yourself is to invest in yourself as a woman. You know, don't look at the gender aspect. Look as a profession. Get the best that you can be. Invest in yourself and be the best that you can be in that profession. And then you go out there and you make it happen. You know, you show that you're better than the other guy, the guy that's next to you. And that will get you, you know, because if you have a good product, people will understand. The one thing also that's important of women out there is you have to respect everybody and you have to demand respect.
That's Lydia Bastianich, and our conversation recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Stay with us for more from my interview with Lydia, including what lessons she's taken from working in an all-boys club.
This is NHPR 945. Good morning.
Has the president hijacked July 4th for political purposes? His plans include a speech from the Lincoln Memorial and what aides have pitched as a patriotic salute to the military. Others say he's co-opting a nonpartisan celebration and behaving like a tin pot dictator. The furor around this year's fireworks in Washington. Next time on 1A.
That's this morning at 10 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Ed Riley Subaru in Concord, a local family-run business serving the needs of New Hampshire's Subaru owners and buyers for over 24 years. Details at edrileysubaru.com. am from Alliance Audiology in Concord, offering compassion and a sense of humor, as well as over 100 years combined experience addressing hearing needs. Alliance Audiology, LLC.com. This is NHPR.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Lydia Bastianich, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Here's Lydia answering audience questions about workplace harassment within the restaurant industry. Along those lines, we have a question from the audience. Have you ever experienced harassment in your career?
I think, you know, when you're young and whatever, absolutely, you know, there's, and again, I was always in the family situation, but when you went out and you did, or events or other things, inevitably, you know, there was that word or that smirk or whatever. Yes, but I think, you know, if you stand your ground as a woman and you're secure of yourself, that you stand a much better chance. And, you know, if it doesn't, just move on, you know.
Can you tell us an example of the time that you did have to stand your ground in a moment like that?
Well, I mean, you know, I you walk and they touch your butt, so you turn around and you smack them.
That gives them the message.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another question from the audience. Did you ever confront Mario Batali about his behavior, assuming you knew about it?
I didn't know the depth of his behavior. I think, you know, the going out and drinking and whatever, you know, that's not, we were partners, but, you know, he was a mature man, and I was not up to, he always considered me as his mother, you know, a second mother, whatever, but, and we talked about health-wise, he was, at one point, he had an aneurysm and whatever, so we talked about drinking and all of that. But, you know, I was, being a partner, I was in a position to reprimand him personally. I didn't know everything else that went on.
You did not?
No.
Yeah. Did you, and your son Joe was both business partners and friends with him. Did you worry about Joe? I mean, he seemed to have done a lot of partying with Mario.
You know, as I said, I don't think that, you know, I knew everything else. I was always, you know, telling them and whatever, you know, make sure you get your rest, make sure you don't overdrink, you make sure, you know, the same things that mothers always do. You know, I wasn't different because I was a chef and their partner. Actually, it put me in a, you know, like I was in a sense their mother, if you will, almost mm-hmm. almost their home. But they were the partner. So yes, you know, you always have something to say. And my son, I was naturally more free than I was with Mario.
Naturally, mothers are. Tend to be free with their sons.
Yes.
When you read your son Joe's book, what was your response to that, both the good and the not so great passages?
Well, I told him. I said, you know, that book. I think some of the things are really good. Describe the restaurant industry, especially in its beginning, and I think some of the things were sensationalistic in a sense, you know, just to create that. And I told him that. And I think also what's happened a lot with food now, especially even in the food show, you know, is this sensationalism with food. Why do we need to go overboard with anything, you know?
Are you referring to, like, the shows that have, like, food contests and stuff?
Contests and all this kind of mess, and I don't, you know. So, I think that, you know, there's a reality because food, as I said, you know, the having of food, they're having not of food, you really appreciate food, and food should be respected and appreciated, and should be should never be wasted, should never be played with, you know. And I feel very strongly about that, and you know, this is so those shows sometimes are not really the reality of food. But I'll tell you one thing, Peter, what I do appreciate about the shows and, you know, the Food Network and all of that, even though the shows that they air are neither here nor there, is that they brought an awareness of food to the public. Mm-hmm. So what you see out of that is this re-entrance, but going back now to 10, 15 years, of people to food. And maybe the idea of I can cook, I can go in the kitchen, I can do, and that I love, because I think when somebody understands food and doesn't depend on somebody else to be fed or to that really demands good quality food, food that is healthy, food that is in season, that watches our environment and all of that, I think that, you know, we are going back into a direction that I feel comfortable in. So these shows and all of that had a play in all of that, even though some of those shows really are not worth the time of the...
I guess we all have our favorite different food shows, cooking shows. One more question about restaurant culture, food industry culture, and it has to do with your company going forward. What do you plan on doing to make sure that the environment is supportive and not toxic for anybody? And perhaps a follow-up question to that is, what should the rest of the industry be doing to make sure that the culture is a healthy one for those working in
well,
it?
Well, for us, it was difficult because Mario was a partner, mm-hmm. so we had to get him out. Mm-hmm. And it took more than a year. I think it was 10 days ago that we finally signed the contract and we bought his shares. And I think, again, we're going to base it on a family. My daughter got very much into it. I mean, she's been with me in the business, the books, the television, Kansas City and Pittsburgh. She's been running those restaurants. And focusing more maybe on empowering women, but having all the needs for the restaurant industry, you know, a handbook, knowing that they have the human HR department, that they can talk to somebody, that somebody will listen. Now we have our head chef at Del Posto, our, you know, Michelin star and was it four or five star restaurant, is a woman, a young woman, Melissa Rodriguez. She is wonderful. Our partner's Nancy Silverton. So we are a lot of women in our company, and we're going to make that ever more present, and work within that the rules, the honest rule of people working, having a place to work comfortably, to be respected. A possibility of growth, and so on. We are making opportunities for people to actually become partners in different parts of our business. As we grow, they can grow with us, and specifically of the capable women in our company.
Mm-hmm. So you have cooked for two popes, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis. What was that like?
Heavenly. No, you know, I got to tell you, when I came home, when they told me, well, let me tell you first how I got into, then I'll tell you what Grandma said. I you know, in this circle of being, you know, really appreciating what people have done for me, there comes a time evermore that you feel like you need to give something back. So I do a lot of humanitarian and fundraising for different organizations in need. And I work with the United Nations closely. In a sense, for the last 10 years, I worked with UNIFEM, United Nations Female Organization. Now it's part of a bigger organization at the United Nations. But that was an organization that specifically worked with single-parent women in third-world countries. And that is that a woman that had a family, you know, was a seamstress, would sew one dress enough to feed the family. There were these microloans, and that just kind of excited me. A microloan where the organization would lend the money to buy a sewing machine to the women. No, that's a $300, $400 investment, not much. And these women now can cook, sew three, four dresses and feel much better about themselves and feed the family. So empowering the women to do what they can. And you know that more than 90% of these loans were returned by these women? I mean, it's amazing. And now I'm working with an organization also at the United Nations where every child that is in a refugee camp, and being in a refugee camp, I can really relate, loses 2 years of education. So not in this United States, but around the world, these camps that you see, children lose 2 years of their education. So when finally they do make a place, they do reach a place where they can kind of continue to live, they are 2 years behind. So the United Nations is collecting money to build schools in these refugee camps. So I work with them, and they have a most unusual idea, and I love that, is where people can make a dinner even in their house. And the universities really responded to it. Charge for that dinner, whatever you want, $20 to your friends, neighbors, and that's the donation. So you make a dinner, charge for it, and then that's the donation. So it's have dinner with Lydia, in a sense, and so that's so. Working in the United Nations and doing events, I would do events at the delegates' dining room. I met the nuncio from that, which is the ambassador from the Vatican, and he asked me to do some things when he had events. But when Pope Benedict was coming, he came and he said, "Lydia, would you consider cooking for the Pope?" And I said, "Sure," you know. No, I mean, yeah, I thought he was joking, but you know, and you know, he says, no, I'm serious. He's coming, and I will let you know. And sure enough, it evolved that he did come, and you know, I was nervous in the beginning. You begin to communicate with the Vatican, send the menu and ideas, and now you know, the popes when they travel, they don't go to hotels or restaurants. They usually go into the nuncio's house, which is the Vatican's ambassador's home. And that's where I cooked. You know, there was a double brownstone on 72nd Street in New York, right off Fifth Avenue. And he had his little room upstairs, and then there was the dining room and my kitchen. So, you know, it's like living in this. And it was extraordinary because it is really like living with, I mean, he would come down for breakfast, you know, had his meeting, lunch. So it was extraordinary. So I'm going to tell you now, you guys have to look at me, what my mother said. So I came home. And I says, "Ma, you won't believe who they asked me to cook for." She says, "Who? You cooked for presidents, you cooked for personalities, Sophia Loren, Gina Lollobrigida." I says, "Mom, they asked me to cook for the Pope." And she goes, "And next, who are you going to cook for next?" And I says, "I'm not going there yet. I'm not..."
What an incredible experience. Your book references your American dream. Someone from the audience wanted to know, what's your next dream?
I think, you know, I've been so blessed that I think I couldn't ask for another dream. But, you know, I am always one to say, you know, look at the opportunities when they're coming. And so you know, I'm attentive. There's something that I would love to do in the future, certainly, you know. I love doing my television. I love doing the books. I think evermore, maybe, you know, sort of giving to others, returning, and the food situation around the world. You know, there are people still that don't have food. So work with those needy situation as I am evermore.
Well, Lydia Bastianich, thank you very much for being here on Writers on Immigrant News.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
That's Lydia Bastianich, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. Producer and literary coordinator is Brittany Wasson. The live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. Broadcast producer for NHPR is Emily Quirk. Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Photos from the event by David J. Murray are posted online at cleareyephoto.com. I'm Peter Biello, and this has been a special broadcast from New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR. I'm Dan Kogan. Good morning. 1A is next at 10 o'clock.
Hi, I'm Deb Turner, NHPR's Vice President for Development. NHPR constantly evolves to remain relevant to the needs of you, our listeners. In return, you have graced us with your unflagging support and remarkable generosity. To everyone who's taken a moment to contribute to NHPR this June and over the past year, please accept my heartfelt thanks. Your impact is real, and your continued commitment to public radio here in New Hampshire is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Norscott and Cancer Center, hosting the 38th Prouty Charity Challenge July 13th in Hanover, New Hampshire. Registration at theprouty.org. And from Solarflect Energy, whose solar trackers follow the sun all day, allowing homeowners and small businesses to help solve climate change right in their own backyards and fields. Backyard.solar.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.